like her.
You'll have to learn to feed him, Sister Josephine said. You'll do it for a few days until he's ready to go home.
Teresa stared down at her son, this beautiful creature with wavy black hair and blue eyes. He was so clearly Walter's boy, the only proof of what the two of them had been.
Like this, the nun said, trying to avert her eyes and unbutton the top of Teresa's nightgown at the same time.
Go on.
Teresa put the baby to her right breast and nudged his chin up to latch onto her nipple. She had to attempt it three times before he understood. A strange and extraordinary thing to watch a child so young learn something new.
I'm going to name him Patrick, she said.
I think it's up to your sister to name him, Kate.
My name is Teresa.
They were both silent until the nun continued.
It's such a kind thing your sister is doing. Most girls here won't ever see their babies again. She fought very hard for you.
When Nora visited for the first time, only the two of them and the child in the room, Teresa said,
I want to call the baby Patrick.
Fine, Nora said.
You don't need to do what you planned, Teresa said. I've decided I'll raise him myself.
How on earth do you imagine you'll do that?
Sister Josephine came in then. She went to the baby who had started to fuss in the bassinet. She patted his head, lifted him up.
I wonder, Nora said, if we might bring them both home sooner. Today even. I'm sorry, no. Sister Josephine's tone grew curt. We have a way of doing things. Rules must be followed, even in a situation as unusual as this one.
Teresa wondered what made it unusual. She thought for the first time of the family Sister Bernadette had mentioned that first day. The family who had been chosen to raise her son. She felt overcome by the injustice of the thing. To this good Catholic family, a baby would appear, begotten, not made, like Jesus in the Nicene Creed, or so it would seem. But no one had spoken of them. Her baby was going to be Nora's now instead. The next day came, and then the next. Teresa rocked Patrick, fed him, walked the halls with him in her arms to stop him from crying. She could not believe he was what had been inside her all this time.
I'm sorry I called you a boil, she whispered to him once.
On what was to be her fourth and final night alone with him, Teresa stayed awake past dawn, staring down at his face. The nuns wanted to take the baby to the nursery to sleep, but she begged to keep him with her. In the morning, they told her, the usual protocol would be followed. Patrick would be taken from her and brought to his new parents in some other room. Nora and Charlie would come get her afterward, the baby in Nora's arms. A clean slate, a new story. When the moment came, Teresa felt that she might die.
It's time, said Sister Josephine. His parents are here.
She held out her hands. She began fussing with the baby, even though Teresa still held him. Sister Josephine took a white plastic comb from her pocket and smoothed Patrick's hair. She pinned something small to his diaper.
What's that? Teresa asked.
The medal of the Immaculate Conception. We give them to all our babies when they go home.
The miraculous medal, Teresa said.
That's right. Just one more minute now. Say your goodbyes.
The nun left the room.
Teresa looked down at the tiny silver oval. There was a ring of blue around the edge. The familiar Virgin bathed in light, and the words, "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee." She thought for the first time in years about how the medal came to be, how the Virgin appeared to St. Catherine in a Paris church and commanded her to make these medals so that they might protect whoever wore them. Teresa's favorite part always was the rebellion. She loved when Mary said, "God wishes to charge you with a mission. You will be contradicted, but do not fear. You will have the grace to do what is necessary." Teresa felt the power of Mary and all the saints with her now. When Sister Josephine returned and said,
"All right, darling, give him to me,"
Teresa said, "No." She said it softly. Even so, she surprised herself, saying no to a nun. The sound grew louder. "No, no, 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 no!" "Sister Bernadette," Sister Josephine said, panic in her voice. She went quickly from the room. Teresa looked out the window at where Mary had been, and then down at the medal, St. Catherine. And here, all these weeks, they had called her Kate. She understood. The nuns flew in, their black robes swooping like witches' cloaks. Sister Bernadette didn't say anything, just came to her and tried to take Patrick from her arms. Teresa held tight to the child and screamed. She heard the noises and felt shocked by them, as if they weren't coming from her own mouth. Patrick started to cry.
"See what you've done to him," Sister Bernadette said.
"He's mine," Teresa yelled. "They can't take him."
Sister Bernadette said sharply,
"You signed the paper. This child shouldn't suffer for your sins. Give him to me before I call the police. You're an unwed, unfit harlot." She turned to Sister Josephine. "I warned you this would happen."
Sister Josephine looked distressed. "If you love him, let him have a real home," she said. "A mother and a father. Someday you'll have a child of your own. For now, you'll make a lovely auntie." When Teresa glared at her, Sister Josephine said, "I'll get the sister." Nora walked in a few minutes later, Charlie behind her. They were dressed in their Sunday best, as if they were off to Easter Mass.
"Don't make me, Nora," Teresa begged.
"Everyone's excited to see you," Charlie said. "Mrs. Quinlan keeps saying the house isn't the same without you. We're supposed to go over there for dinner tomorrow. She's making a strawberry pie."
Teresa regarded Nora and Charlie, husband and wife. They expected her to go home and eat pie and invent stories about the summer as if her son had never been born, after they had forced her to come here. Her sister was forever trying to tame her, clean her up for the world. Nora had married a silly man she didn't love. How could the fact of his existence make her more of a mother than Teresa was to her own child? She could tell from their faces that they were just as terrified as she was. Teresa was growing tired. She needed Nora to understand.
"I had a sign,"
she said, bitter tears pricking at her eyes.
"He's meant to be mine. I'll take him away from here tonight."
"Where would you go?" Nora said.
"Please help me," Teresa said. "Please. If you don't. I'll find a way to keep him just the same. I'll tell everyone what you've done to me. I'll scream it in the streets. I'll run off with him and you'll never find us.
Teresa,
Nora said. Her sister came up close. She made her voice soft and low, the way she did when Teresa was a child and needed soothing.
You're going to be a teacher, Nora said. You're going to meet a wonderful man.
Remember the ones your friend on the ship told you about? Rich and handsome. You'll find one just like that. And Patrick will always be near you. This is the only way.
Stop this chatter now, said Sister Bernadette. There will be no more discussion.
She took the baby from Teresa's arms and handed him to Nora. Part 3, 2009. Chapter 6. The nuns at the Abbey of the Immaculate Conception chanted 7 times daily at the ringing of the bells. The 2 a.m. call to matins was the most difficult, and so, Mother Cecilia believed, most important. She had long since trained herself to wake up for it, to dress and get to the chapel, alert and attentive to the prayers at hand. On Monday morning at 1:30, she rose in darkness and noticed the silence. After 7 straight days, the rain had stopped. Over the course of the previous week, every corner of the Abbey's 400 acres had gotten so thoroughly drenched that the flat rubber soles of the nuns' shoes sank into the grass and seemed to want to stay there, stuck in the mud, forcing the grudging earth up with each step. All over the property, the branches of 200-year-old pine trees sagged, threatening to snap. In the raised vegetable beds, the last of the winter broccoli stalks grew heavy with water. The beanstalks that climbed the lattice fence shook in the wind. The goats and cows and llama had to be coaxed from the barns with ripe pears. Even the dogs, 4 yellow Labradors who had spent so many happy afternoons getting filthy in the river, wanted to stay indoors, darting out only a few feet from the porch and right back in again each morning. The river itself had overflowed, swamping its banks. Inside, moisture clung to every surface. Someone was assigned to wipe down the valves of the chapel organ at regular intervals for fear that they might rust. Wooden doors throughout the dormitory had swollen from the humidity and refused to shut. A damp cold filled the long stone corridors. Everyone was in a wretched mood. Old tensions resumed, and new ones sprang up like mushrooms, taking them all by surprise. In her cell, rain dripped through cracks in the ceiling into 3 saucepans at the foot of the bed. Every night, she listened to the rhythmic tapping of each drop as it landed and wondered how they would afford a new roof. But now, at last, it was over. After matins, she fell back to sleep in an instant. When the bells rang again at dawn, she dressed, feeling content. She went about her morning plans, mass and paperwork and baking bread, with a cheerful sense of order restored. She praised the beautiful day to the postman and the youngsters staying in the guest house. They all complained that the air had turned cold, but that was to be expected in Vermont in January. It was the unseasonable warmth that had brought them rain in the first place. She preferred the winter weather. Even at her age, she still got excited by the sight of the Abbey in snow. Breakfast was served promptly at 8. She slipped into the refectory a minute before the hour and took her seat. There were at present 37 of them. They ate their meals in silence at two long, thin wooden tables, side by side, no one facing anyone else. She and the Mother Abbess sat together at a small head table. Today, as usual, the others bowed before them as they filed in. Because Mother Cecilia recalled with perfect clarity when they were a pair of young postulants, this always took her by surprise. While they ate their eggs, their bread and jam, she noticed Sister Alma looking at her from across the room. Mother Cecilia nodded, and the girl nodded back with a sad smile. She supposed Sister Alma would come to her afterwards seeking counsel, as she often had recently. In 4 days' time, she would make her final vows. They had all been anticipating it, making preparations in the kitchen and the guest quarters. On Thursday, Sister Alma would become Mother Alma, a permanent member of their community. You weren't supposed to be more or less fond of one girl or another, but Mother Cecilia couldn't help privately favoring some. Sister Alma had arrived 7 years ago with a master's in fine arts from the Rhode Island School of Design. She was a painter in New York who had begun to show her work in galleries to make a name for herself. But then she felt called to something greater. She came to the Abbey wearing platform sandals with black leather straps that wrapped around her calves and a dress that was longer in the back than it was in the front. Like many of them, Sister Alma started as an intern. She lived in the women's guest house for 4 months and helped with the harvest. She mopped the church floor and scrubbed the pails the nuns used to churn butter. At the end of her term, she asked for a meeting with Mother Cecilia. Of all her jobs, the role of novice mistress was the most essential. Mother Cecilia was the one who helped them decide whether or not they belonged here. In that first meeting, Sister Alma spoke of how, with 30, had come the realization that many of her friends were only playing at poverty. Once some milestone was reached, a birthday or a marriage or a birth, they moved into million-dollar brownstones. They invited people over for brunch in the garden, and everyone commented approvingly on their beautiful furniture, their elegant sense of style. No one asked where the money came from, perhaps because they knew, rich parents or a fortuitous marriage, or a fortuitous marriage to someone with rich parents. Suddenly, after a decade devoted only to ideas and emotions, things had become paramount. She spoke, too, of the burdens of technology. There was not a young one through the door these recent years who failed to mention how pleased she would be to give up her email account, her cell phone. The word they all used was noise. They could barely stand the noise. Life had become too full of it. There were some in the Abbey's hierarchy who questioned this motive. A few thought it showed a lack of devotion, but Mother Cecilia disagreed. Every generation had arrived at the Abbey burdened by its own trials. Each nun was a product of her time, like anyone. Over half a century, she watched them come in waves. In the 70s, they came seeking peace, community, social justice. Now they wanted life to have meaning. They wanted quiet around them and within. Anything might have led them here. What kept them here was faith. Some convents had girls as young as 16, 17 years old streaming in, though she doubted many stayed for long. Immaculate Conception did not accept women who hadn't had some life experience, a talent, or a profession. One of them had been a Broadway actress, another a Wall Street banker, another still a state senator in Wisconsin. They had a sculptor, whom the Abbey sent to Rome to learn marble carving, and a former chemist who made perfumes. Their gifts from those past lives enriched the present. Sister Alma said a professor of hers had told his students that the artist's life was unthinkably hard, that if they could envision themselves doing anything else, then they ought to. It applied just as well to being a nun, she said. Mother Cecilia agreed, and yet she thought it could apply to anything. A mother's life was that absolute and could never be undone. Still, most women chose it. But the artist parallel was a good one. Perhaps an artist felt more deeply than most people, and yet the trade-off was the doubt. She had once read that it took Gillot hours every morning to get Picasso out of bed and to work, a daily ritual of despair to hope. Faith was not a constant. Faith took reviving. A nun did not become a nun all at once, but bit by bit. This was what she planned to remind Sister Alma of after breakfast. But when Sister Alma knocked on her office door, she bowed before her and said, "There was a call for you on the hotline this morning, Mother." Mother Cecilia gestured for her to come in. They had added the hotline for those who couldn't get to the Abbey to have their prayers heard. They prayed for whatever they were asked, for personal tragedies and world disasters, for soldiers in Iraq and cancer patients at the hospital up the road. It was not unheard of for a caller to have some personal connection to one of the nuns, but Mother Cecilia had never before been the reason for a call. The woman's name was Nora Rafferty, Sister Alma said, glancing at a slip of paper in her hand. She wanted me to tell you that her son died last night. He was in a car accident. It must have been weather-related. She said there was no one else involved. She felt like the air had been squeezed from her lungs. She tried to keep her voice even. Did she say which son? She said his name was Patrick. In the last picture she ever saw, he was 16 years old. It was how she imagined him now, though he had turned 50 in August. "Did you know them well, Mother?" Sister Alma said. "A long time ago, yes." The girl looked surprised. As far as anyone but Mother Placid knew, Mother Cecilia had no people of her own in this country. "I'm so sorry," Sister Alma said. "I'll pray for them. And shall I add him to this evening's prayers?" "No," she said, but then she changed her mind. "Yes, I mean, that would be nice. Thank you." Sister Alma left the room and closed the door behind her. Mother Cecilia began to cry. A car accident. No one else involved. She had made peace with her decision long ago. To leave him with Nora was to leave him to Nora. But Nora hadn't done enough. She hadn't listened. Now this. She took a breath. At Immaculate Conception, they believed that dealing with their struggles in the service of God could have a positive effect on the rest of the world. When you took your final vows, you became a religious, and then every act you did became an act of religion. She was meant to wrestle with what was difficult in life, especially in her own family. Compassion, then, for Nora, for herself. Her choices made in another lifetime, when they knew nothing of the world, nothing of their history, nothing even of their own bodies and what they were capable of. The silence was a form of violence. She had tried to get Nora to see it, but Nora refused. She pictured her now, distraught, but surrounded by her children, her husband, Charlie's enormous family, all those characters she had lived with once upon a time. Nora's children were grown. She had often imagined them married with children of their own, settled, content. Nora and Charlie, the proud grandparents of an ever-growing brood. She wondered now if Patrick had left behind a wife, daughters and sons who loved him. Mother Cecilia got up from her chair. She walked outside, feeling lightheaded. She found Mother Placid doing the composting. Mother Placid wore her heavy denim habit with a sweatshirt over the top, work boots with yellow laces, the edges of the soles caked in mud. Her dear old friend, keeper of all her secrets. So long since the two of them came through the Abbey gates together, since they called each other by their given names. Decades had passed since the last time she thought of herself as Teresa. Seeing her expression, Mother Placid gave her a worried smile.
What is it?
Mother Cecilia took hold of the other woman's arm to steady herself. Patrick is dead.
My God, what happened?
A car accident. My sister called.
Really?
She had not spoken to Nora in more than 30 years. The letters Mother Cecilia had written were returned, unopened, dozens of them, still in a box beneath her bed.
You should go to Boston for the funeral.
I can't.
Yes, you can. This is just what we voted on.
She said it as if it were that simple. The trips home had been controversial with some of the oldest nuns. They ran counter to what the cloister had been built on for centuries. You came, and if you were devout, you never left. But in recent years, some abbeys had begun to soften the rules. If someone died or was dying, if your family needed you, you could go away for a short time. The Abbey had decided to allow the visits in extreme cases, but until now, they had only been theoretical. Mother Cecilia had argued that these visits were crucial. Motive and intention were everything. Half the postulants would leave for good, either by their own decision or at the vote of the other nuns. The ones who stayed were called to it and could not be pulled away by circumstance. She had never dreamed that she'd be the first to go, that Patrick would be the reason. "I can't leave you now," she said, "not with Bishop Dolan set to arrive any day. Bearing bad news, I would assume."
"You go when you need it. Isn't that what we decided? I, for one, am not at all afraid of Dickie Dolan."
"Please don't call him that. You make me nervous."
"It seems to me that it's right," Mother Placid said. "Nora wants you there. Think about it. Pray on it."
"I will." Chapter 7. John Rafferty sipped his coffee, regarding his wife as she screwed the back onto a pearl earring, her head cocked to one side. "What time do you think you'll be home?" Julia said,
Because, you know, the thing. She nodded toward their daughter at the table. Maeve sat staring at her phone, earbuds jammed in, oblivious. John's flight to Chicago was at 10. He'd return on the 4 o'clock. It was not a good day for a teenage mini-drama, but then it never was. "I'll definitely be back by 8:30 at the latest," he said. He almost set his mug down on the kitchen island, but at the last second he remembered the new countertop. Julia had had the white marble installed a month ago. The previous marble, only a year old, was black, which, she said, washed out the rest of the kitchen. John thought he could see what she meant. He preferred not to think about the cost. If they could get a few years' use out of the white, it might not seem so extravagant. He just wouldn't put anything on it until he was 50. "You okay?" Julia said. If she knew what he was thinking, she would say they both worked hard, they could afford it. She would tell him to relax. John sometimes wondered if anyone, upon being told to relax in such a manner, had ever actually succeeded at relaxing. "I'm fine," he said.
"We're leaving for school in 5 minutes," Julia said.
Maeve didn't look up.
"Hello?" Julia called. "I need to be in the office by 8:30. Big client coming in at 9. Chop, chop."
She sighed.
"She's ignoring me."
"She can't hear you," he said, lying for Julia's benefit. John walked over and tapped Maeve on the shoulder. She pulled out a single bud. "Your mother's talking to you. Go get ready for school. You're leaving in 5. She half glared at him, but she got up, shuffled off.
"And we're having a family meeting tonight," Julia shouted after her. "Get pumped for that."
"Does she seem off this morning?" Julia whispered once Maeve was upstairs. "Do you think she knows that we know, or is she just being herself?"
"The latter," he said.
Julia could always come up with a reason why Maeve was being a shit. She was underslept from going to a slumber party. She was in a fight with a friend. Her upcoming math test had her on edge. The truth was that the day she turned 13, their daughter had begun to torture them like it was her job, Julia especially. Maeve spoke to her in ways John would never have dared speak to any adult, especially his mother. When he even thought of it, he swore he could taste the soap Nora had used to wash his mouth out 30 years earlier. Julia was raised the only child of academics in Palo Alto, parents whose cultural preferences were as important to her upbringing as the lessons of how to tie her shoes or stop at the crosswalk. They liked Simon and Garfunkel and Joan Didion and Ethiopian food. She was expected to like these things, too. More than that, she did like them. Half the albums she now owned had been pinched from her father's collection. John thought it best to take his parenting cues from her. When Maeve was small, he played Barbies with her and Calico Critters and Beauty Parlor. "I can't picture this," his sister Bridget said when Julia mentioned it once. Had his own parents ever gotten down on the floor and played with them? He was positive they had not. But after a day spent fighting with overblown, self-satisfied politicians and their hangers-on, there was nothing John enjoyed more than giving voice to a tiny plastic rabbit or a Ken doll with painted-on sideburns. It took so little to delight his daughter then. Even when Maeve was a toddler, Julia felt it was important for them to speak to her with respect. If Maeve begged for one cookie too many,
Julia tried to explain precisely why it was a bad idea, instead of just saying no. John's mother would have said something like, "The doctor called and told me that if you eat another bite of sugar, your stomach will explode and you'll die." It amazed him how mild Julia was, how patient. She didn't yell, or even have a look that communicated the threat. "You'll spoil her rotten," Nora warned. "Children crave discipline." But Maeve was a miracle. The thing they had tried for and wished for and finally gotten. They were more terrified of scaring her than they were of spoiling her. Every interaction felt important, as if she would be talking about it in therapy 20 years on if they didn't play their cards right. When he was a child, John's mother might slap him with one hand and a minute later give him a popsicle with the other. The whole thing forgotten, forgiven. "There's no justification for physical abuse," Julia said. "Why would I want my own child to fear me?" He thought the word abuse was going too far, but he didn't know how he could ever hit Maeve and then look her in the eye. Had John feared his mother? Yes, of course, without question. Throughout Maeve's childhood, their only form of discipline was time out. It wasn't exactly a torture chamber. Maeve was made to sit on the bottom step of the staircase with a book for 5 minutes. He had noted an expression on her face during those sessions. John thought about it a lot these days. It seemed to say, "This is a joke, and we both know it. This will accomplish nothing." Maybe his mother had been right. Now Maeve lived inside her cell phone, constantly laughing or gasping at something she saw there. When Julia asked, "What is it?" Maeve would say without fail, "Nothing." They had once been close, but now Julia said the only time she learned anything about their daughter's life was when she was driving Maeve and her friends to soccer practice or the mall. In the back seat, they'd dissect in great detail who they were mad at, who was mad at them, who had kissed a boy. The girls called kissing scooping, so she wouldn't know what they were talking about. Julia longed to know more. But, she said, her only parental superpower was invisibility. If she asked a question, she would break the spell. Maeve's adoption had taken on new importance to her. Here, too, she found them lacking. There had been one horrible fight when he could almost see the words taking shape in her mouth, just as John began to wonder how he might stop them. They were out.
"You can't tell me what to do. You're not really my mother."
A few months ago, Julia had started checking the browser history on Maeve's laptop to make sure she wasn't developing an eating disorder or chatting with 40-year-old men. John was against it. He said she was bound to discover something awful if she looked hard enough. Lo and behold, last night, while Maeve was sleeping, Julia found the browser open to a page called The Finding Place. It was an online group offering to reunite girls with their birth mothers. There were discussion topics like not fully belonging in either world and was it legal adoption or trafficking. Julia brought the computer to him, held it out as if it were evidence from a crime scene. They had talked about it for 3 hours, time he was planning to use to prepare for today's meeting. They hadn't revealed to Maeve yet that they knew. They would tell her tonight, once he got back. John could tell Julia was on edge about it. He wanted to console her.
But the timing was bad. He needed to focus. He needed the money this trip could potentially bring in. Otherwise, something would have to give. His cell phone buzzed on the counter. Julia was closer.
"Is it the car service?" he said.
She looked down. "It's your mother." It was as if he had conjured her with those words, "car service." As if Nora knew somehow that he was not driving himself to the airport, the only fiscally sensible choice since he was returning in just a few hours, but that instead John was taking a $100 car ride so that he could stare at the New York Times on his BlackBerry in traffic.
"I'll call her back," he said.
Julia's phone started to ring. She took it from her pocket and frowned. Nora again.
"It's about the article," John said. "Let it go to voicemail."
He had expected her to call yesterday to congratulate him on the great piece in the Globe. The headline made the cover of the Sunday Metro section. "State Senator-elect Rory McLean vows to fight opiate abuse, recalls childhood friends' long battle." It had taken weeks of finagling on John's end. He thought it was a brilliant way of silencing all the naysayers from the old neighborhood who claimed Rory was out of touch with his roots. Try saying that once you knew that one of his best buddies from high school, blinded as a teenager, had ended up a dropout, living among the junkies on the streets of Portland, Maine for years and years. Until Rory got involved and brought him home to Dorchester, set him up with an apartment and a job washing dishes in his cousin's coffee shop in Adams Village. The paper had put a photo of Rory and his family on the front page of the section. Inside, on page 8, was a small black-and-white picture of the two friends, Rory and Peter O'Shea, as children. The pair of them in their swimming trunks at Carson Beach, arms around each other's shoulders. John was quoted in the third paragraph. All day yesterday, people had called him to mention it. But Nora stayed silent. She had something out for Rory, for no reason John could comprehend. Maybe, like a lot of people, she didn't trust an Irish Republican. Or maybe she thought Rory was full of himself. But that couldn't be further from the truth. He hadn't even wanted the article. John had heard him tell the Pete O'Shea story at a small fundraiser. When he suggested they run with it in the press, Rory said he wouldn't feel right about it, that he hadn't done anything to help the guy that anybody else wouldn't have done. That was Rory McLean, humble to a fault. Rory was a few years older than John, his brother Patrick's age. Patrick couldn't stand the guy either. "He was a bad seed in high school," Pat said when John first asked if they knew each other. John thought it was more about him stepping into Patrick's territory or some macho nonsense like that than it was about Rory himself. It all came to a head on the day of Maeve's confirmation 8 months ago, Patrick making a drunken scene. They hadn't spoken since. At the confirmation, Pat got all bent out of shape when he saw Rory and his wife at the church.
"What's that shithead doing here?" he said.
"Shut up," John whispered. "You know I'm working with him now. Whatever it is, Patrick, keep it to yourself." During the lunch at John's country club after, Pat got wasted. An old client of John's somehow mistook him for a co-worker of Julia's.
"So you're a lawyer, too?" the guy said.
Patrick laughed, an obnoxious drunken snort.
"He runs a bar," John said, and if there was a hint of condescension to his tone, then good. Pat deserved it.
His brother looked him in the eye.
We can't all be professional sellouts.
John's client smiled awkwardly and got up to refresh his drink.
Fuck you, John said under his breath.
Lunch passed in normal order. Soup, then salad, then salmon or chicken, whatever a person chose. The waitresses were just pouring the coffee when there was a commotion in the lobby. John made a gesture that everyone should sit tight, and then he left and found Patrick and Rory stumbling out of the men's room. Chip, the manager of the club, got between them.
"He actually tried to hit him," an old man in a sweater vest said, astonished. He was pointing at Patrick.
Chip set his eyes on Pat.
"Sir, that's not the sort of behavior we allow here," he said in a stern voice. "I know you're a guest of Mr. Rafferty, but..."
John saw the red and blue lights flashing through the front windows. Someone had called the police. His cousin Connor was behind him a minute later, walking across the lobby, pushing through the front door. John knew Connor would meet the officers out front, explain that he was a Boston cop himself, that it was just a family thing.
"There's really no need for this," Rory said to Chip. "It was a misunderstanding."
Nora came from the dining room then, with such a crumpled look on her face. Pat walked out, with Nora on his heels.
"I am so sorry," John said to Rory. "Are you okay?" "I don't know what to say. I'm mortified." "Don't worry about it," Rory said, clapping him on the back. "I've got drinkers in my family, too. He was just having a bad day. Come on, let's go have some cake."
He never mentioned it to John again, even as the memory made John burn with shame. He had known for a long time that Patrick couldn't stand him. But who did a thing like that? What had he ever done to Patrick to make him want to humiliate his own brother? Patrick sent Julia roses from Stapleton Floral the next day, and Maeve a crisp $100 bill tucked into a greeting card. But that had been it for John. Nora refused to take sides, which John saw as her taking Patrick's side, since he was clearly in the wrong. She said it was unthinkable for brothers to go on this way over something so small. She told John that the McLeans were bad people, that he shouldn't have gotten involved with anyone from that family. But Nora had nothing to back it up, just a gut feeling. She had moved away 30 years ago. Any petty grudge she held would be ancient history. Maybe, like Patrick, Rory was a little wild in his day. But like John, he had made something of himself. They had a lot in common. Rory's dad had been a bigwig at the Edison. He died the same year Charlie did. Rory wasn't John's biggest client by a long shot, but his win in November had been an important one, unlikely as it was. Even then, Nora didn't offer congratulations. John thought Patrick might finally apologize to him, to Rory. But Patrick didn't say a word. There were plenty of times over the years when the two of them stopped speaking for weeks or months at a stretch. John had once taken the girls to Castle Island for lunch during one of these periods. They parked their car in the lot outside Sullivan's and looked out over Pleasure Bay. Patrick happened to pull in right beside them, a cheap-looking blonde in the passenger seat. Julia didn't even notice him there. John and Patrick sat, eating their hot dogs, side by side, never once acknowledging each other's presence. After Julia left to take Maeve to school, Nora called again. John stood in the driveway in his suit and overcoat,
his briefcase on the ground behind him, waiting for the car to arrive. The air was so cold that it almost hurt to breathe. He threw some salt down, careful to avoid his good shoes. He didn't stop to answer the phone. It would be more efficient to call his mother back from the airport when there was time to kill. While he had these few moments alone, he needed to think about strategy for this afternoon. He wanted to impress upon the client that while he might be the most expensive option, you got what you paid for. Would they go for that? He looked down the block at all the other houses just like his. The first few months they lived here, he had pulled up in front of the wrong one at least once a week. The development was 8 years old. New houses made to look old on streets that hadn't been there a decade ago, with names like Oaken Bucket Road and White Dove Lane. Theirs was called Hidden Valley Drive. "Your street is named after a salad dressing," his sister Bridget had said. "You need to own that." She was obsessed with the size of the house. "What's the matter, John boy? You couldn't find a bigger one?" What could he say? Somewhere along the line, a 6-bedroom brick colonial had come to seem normal. One time in 10, he might arrive home from work and marvel like a kid. "A mansion," he would have called it when he was young. His mother still called it that. 2 times in 10, the house came into view and his chest clenched, thinking of what would happen if things took one bad turn and he lost it all. His family thought he was rich now, but he and Julia had nothing compared to most of the people in their circle. Part of him still felt as if he had tricked Julia into thinking he was one thing, when in fact he was another. You could make yourself look like anything at college, away from your family. He and Julia were so young then. She was the most incredible woman he'd ever met. He was willing to say anything to have her. Now, the fear that spiraled through his head late at night was that one day she would look over and realize he was an imposter. The fear kept him going. That and the thought of his parents, who had done so much to give their kids a better life. None of them had done anything to equal the sacrifices Nora and Charlie had made. His mother didn't even have a high school education. His father, just that. Yet somehow, they had supported a family of 6 in a country that wasn't their own. Through means no one had ever understood, they had left Dorchester and moved their children into the biggest, nicest house in Hull when John was 11 years old. Hull wasn't an expensive town like the one he lived in now, but even so. For 40 years, Charlie held court at Doyle's Hardware Store in Quincy Center. He worked his ass off, painting houses inside and out. In the winter months, he hung wallpaper and did odd jobs. But when he wasn't working, he was at Doyle's. People came to ask him which colors they should go with, how to fix a leaky kitchen faucet. Charlie loved being the expert. The guys at Doyle's sent him all their customers. If you bought a can of paint from Mike Doyle, Charlie Rafferty would be the one to put it on your walls. Guaranteed. When a Home Depot opened in Quincy, Doyle's was forced to close. Charlie kept working, but without his spot at the shop, he was diminished. He went to Home Depot on a Saturday morning and eavesdropped on the salesman, then gave the customers his own unsolicited opinion. For a time, he had wanted John to come into the business with him. Charlie seemed almost disappointed when John got into Georgetown on a scholarship, even as he bragged about it to everyone he met. John had wanted to work in politics since he was 5 years old. After he graduated, he got low-level campaign jobs, working for a guy running for Cambridge City Councilor, and then the first female treasurer of Rhode Island. He got a rush from helping them win. The late nights, all hands on deck. He believed in the things they said. It meant something just to be near a person like that, to fetch him a glass of water or call her a car. His father was so damn proud. He'd show up at a speech in a high school gym 50 miles from home just to see John in action. At 28, he went to work for a Democratic consultant, a guy known for running all of Boston's big races. His boss never let him do much more than go to campaign events out in the boonies. So many events, he barely ever saw his wife. John wanted so badly to stand out. He worked like a dog. He applied for better jobs, but guys like him were a dime a dozen. It was impossible to compete. He tried to play up the Irish thing, but even a story of two parents off the boat wasn't worth much. The kid in the office next to his at the State House had a mother from Donegal who had lived in Hyde Park for 40 years and still spoke only Irish. When John asked his boss and other older guys in the party why he wasn't rising as fast as he thought he ought to, they clapped him on the back and told him to be patient. "You're one of the most talented young operatives we've got," they'd say, before passing him over for yet another promotion. After she finished law school at BU, Julia suggested they start fresh somewhere else. The thought terrified him. In Boston, John ran into someone he knew everywhere he went. He liked that. He knew every shortcut in the city, every detour. He knew the best bars and restaurants, half the cops, and all the politicians. He was stuck here, and he loved it here. He wouldn't know where to begin in some other place. Julia got hired on at a good firm. She out-earned him year after year. She said that was a ridiculous thing for him to be bothered by, but John sensed that she was getting impatient. He wasn't living up to the promise she'd seen in him once. So he started his own shop, a one-man operation with exactly one client, the underdog in a city council race. It was a risk he regretted immediately, but 6 months after he opened his doors, the day before his 38th birthday, John was approached by a Republican, a wealthy Mormon businessman who wanted to be governor of Massachusetts. He said he needed an insider heading up his campaign, someone the establishment would recognize as one of their own, so that his differences wouldn't scare them as much. John asked for 2 days to think it over. He felt sick about it. A Republican? A Mormon? He didn't believe in half the guy's positions. And what if his big break, the right one, was just around the corner? When he asked his parents what they thought, Charlie was horrified. Nora, when pressed, said, "What does it matter? They're all crooked anyhow." But the money could not be beat. And life was disappointing sometimes. You moved on. You took a different course. Or else you could end up like his brothers, rehashing the same old stories, wasting your life on what-ifs. John said yes. He tried not to think about how many other guys had turned down the offer first. His risk paid off. His man won, against the odds. Soon enough, he was working for a governor. The organization had strong business ties, tons of money, deep loyalty. Based on one glowing magazine profile written by a friend of Julia's and denounced by half his peers,